Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this September 28. Ron Suskind is our guest this hour of the program. You, I'm sure, are aware that he has a new book, and the book is Confidence Men, Wall Street, Washington, and the Education of a President. Ron spent much time in the White House, interviewed over 200 people for this book, interviewed the president as well, and the book centers, well, it covers a vast period of time, really from the campaign, the Obama campaign, all the way through 2010, and has a special concentration, of course, on the financial collapse that was about to take place right before he was elected president. It looks at key players, who has the president's ears, what the president thinks about and how he's changed from the campaign trail to what he has said during the last couple of years, whether or not there will be a change again, and some very interesting information on a lot of key players, some players we haven't heard that much about who've been very influential in this White House. Ron is a great writer. He's the author. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning author. His books include The Way of the World, The 1% Doctrine, The Price of Loyalty, A Hope in the Unseen. He was the senior national affairs writer for the Wall Street Journal from 1993 to 2000, and that's where he won his Pulitzer Prize, and he is with us this hour of the show. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Hi, Ron.
Hi, Kathleen.
Thank you very much for being with us.
I always love being here.
Good. We love to have you. It's a heck of a book. You're such a fine writer. You've got that gift of being able to tell complicated stories with all of these very marvelous sentences.
Well, and that's a gift. I obviously, as my wife will tell you, I'm a bit of an odd duck. in that I'm an investigative reporter. That's kind of my training. But my Pulitzer is in feature writing. So I believe that, you know, you should, if you dig up the goods, you should present them in a way that is in context and coherent to larger narratives that are shaping, framing, defining of how you get to see the world maybe a little differently. That's
right.
Kind of my thing, as opposed to some other investigative reporters who are brilliant and skilled, but they tend to, you know, lay it out in more of a, you know, like a deposition or a policy paper. Or feature writers who tend not to report much news.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you were taking on such a large number of issues here, particularly the financial crisis, the history of it, and what it meant for this president, and how he dealt with it, and who advised him on this. For me, that would be a tremendously difficult task because I didn't take economics. I mean, obviously, I have to know it in this job, but it's really a huge, huge event to cover, isn't it?
Yeah, it was a big bite of the apple. I'll just leave it at that. You know, I was a Wall Street Journal reporter for 10 years, and I had a lot of sources then and still on Wall Street, the financial capital, I call it, because it really is. I mean, we're really a nation of two capitals, as I point out, have been since the start of the Republic. You know, New York, the capital of private endeavor, Washington of public purpose, and they have fought it out across the many years, the long span of American history for primacy. Generally, New York has been the victor, but Washington has risen up at key moments, often of crisis, to say, no, I've got to do greatest good for greatest number and tame some of the excesses coming from the capital to the north. And I think that you know, the key to the book is to really show how we got here. That's the one sentence,
right?
You know, sort of summation, how
right.
we ended up in this mess. And as well, by virtue of understanding that, offer readers a sense of where we may be going from here. The book is full of arrows, of pointers as to things maybe that weren't done that still, of course, can be done, as well as laying down exactly the forces at work. So the book starts in 2007, even though much of the news has been in the period of the Obama White House and what's gone on in the White House. Readers will find that we start way back when Barack Obama was an asterisk, 30 points behind Hillary Clinton, quite kind of tetchy, a bit frustrated, in fact, in the summer of 2007. And interestingly, his Wall Street advisors, because he's got a lot of Wall Street contributors right from the beginning, and one of them, in a very dramatic scene at the beginning of the book, as he stands up, the head of UBS in America, the big Swiss, the big bank, from Switzerland, he calls Obama on his 46th birthday, having had a glimpse, this financial titan, of a disaster coming.
Right. Yeah.
And he tells Obama, look, this is a once-in-a-lifetime event, a market-driven disaster that's going to maybe melt this economy. Obama gets this precious thing, a glimpse of the future, ahead of any political official in the United States, mind you. And what's sort of poignant about it and powerful is that Obama jumps ahead of everybody. He is the first voice about reforming Wall Street, about taming the excesses of this huge sector of the economy, maybe the most important one, having embraced a wildly speculative business model that's hurting the economy and hurting the American public. Obama is ahead of everyone, and it's part of what gets him elected. He pulls around himself an ecumenical bipartisan group of advisors, Paul Volcker, Bill Donaldson, the former SEC chief under George Bush, Robert Reich, Wolf, the big Wall Street guy. And this team of folks who see the crisis and want to act are doing essentially the American honest broker's kind of effort to say, it's not political. We need to avert a disaster. When Obama gets to the fall of 2008 and the economy does collapse, he is light years ahead of John McCain because he's essentially been tutored by these insiders from Wall Street. So in that audition, as I call it, in the fall of 2008, when you've got an active crisis in the fall of an election, of a presidential election, and both men audition for the top job, Obama crushes McCain. It's Secretariat versus Mr. Ed. It's not even a race, and he becomes the president significantly because he steps up and looks presidential. He's earned that right, but then he kind of breaks into a cold sweat, and I show that in the book where he sort of has that moment where he says, "Oh my God, I might win this thing. You know, I've got to own Washington, tame New York, save the economy from a depression," and he becomes convinced that his urges toward caution, which he has in his personality, are the ones to embrace. And that caution is read as bringing in the old Clinton team,
right,
many of whom were behind some of these disastrous decisions that led to that moment in September of 2008. And that's Larry Summers and Rahm Emanuel and Tim Geithner as his key advisors. And in some ways, the die is cast right there. And you see then the drama unfold as Obama pushes against these advisors. But in some ways, what these men are saying to one another, men with long histories with one another, almost ends up being more defining of this presidency than what Obama says to them at the beginning, in many cases where they are all together wanting to protect Obama from himself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when some of the controversies of the book have grown out of that. This is a hard thing to read. It was a hard thing to report. But that's the story of this time.
It's interesting. You start the book with Elizabeth Warren, and I want you to go back to the time when Elizabeth Warren had Obama in her eyes. She had heard what he had to say. She found him interesting and promising, and she may yet become a rock star regulator, right, considering how she's catching fire right now. But she weaves her way. You write her into the book in several different places, and you start with her. Why do you do that?
Well, I think it's because of what I find by the end of the reporting, which, you know, I have the luxury of having spent two and a half years reporting the book, and then I get to see how the trend lines have moved, is that Warren seemed to embody many of the hopes that people, frankly, felt were housed in Obama. At the start, at the time of the election and the campaign, Warren and Obama looked like kindred, both carrying forward a kind of a vigor that government can do something right and can act dramatically and without, you know, apologies or hesitations. And as they move forward together, Warren remains the subject of enormous fascination and appeal. And Obama seems to lose his way. Warren, in a way, represents the hopes that people invested in Obama, which is why their relationship gets a bit contentious in its way. She, in a way, is calling his cards as to what people hoped he would be like, all the way through to the end of the book where she doesn't get the big job, head of the Consumer Bureau. And you understand exactly what happened.
And it was interesting to look at particularly Geithner's efforts to neutralize her.
Yeah. She was somebody that Wall Street feared profoundly. Mm-hmm. And Geithner, in the fall of 2009, inside of Treasury, they had something called the Elizabeth Warren strategy. How to neutralize this woman who is growing into a larger kind of cultural iconic status. They had a lot of ideas of how to do it, but ultimately none of them really amounted to much because they weren't sure how to engage with her in a way that wouldn't bring invidious comparisons that were negative to the Treasury Secretary. You know, I asked someone on Wall Street, I said, you know, what is it with you and Elizabeth Warren? What she's professing or offering is pretty plain vanilla stuff. Consumer education, anti-fraud, provisions.
Right, right.
I mean, you can't at least be in favor of fraud publicly. And, what is it? And they're like, no, it's not the specifics of what her Consumer Bureau necessarily would try to do. It's she herself. You see, and they explained it to me, that this is the explanation, is that she is operating on a plateau, a cultural landscape above almost anyone else in this debate right now. She's stirred the imagination of many Americans here, coming up with the idea of this Consumer Bureau while she's sitting in her office at Harvard, and then arriving in Washington to essentially breathe life into a new arm of government herself, a one woman's journey. Her personal story is incredibly affecting.
Compelling,
he
yes.
He said, look, if she gets this job, then this Wall Street person, then the financial crisis would have created a true innovation, which is a rock star regulator, not someone sitting with a green with a visor and a little, lamp late at night. No, somebody with consequence. She will then be imitated times 1,000. People will say, I will not go to Wall Street to take the money. I want to be like Elizabeth Warren. And so we have to kill her a warning so she doesn't rise to her fullness. That's what it's about. It's about dealing with these cultural issues of how we see America, how we see government, how we see business, and how we see the larger issues of American definition. That's the idea. That's why they needed to kill her off.
And, Ron, is that what we expected, and is it why we voted for Obama as well?
Well, there's no doubt that many people felt the growing ennui as the 2009 proceeded, saying, wait, is this the guy I elected? I wept when he stepped up on the stage at Grand Park. I was there personally myself.
Were you?
Very emotional, sure.
It was a very emotional night.
Yeah, I wrote a piece for the New York Times Magazine about the end of the Bush era and the beginning of the Obama era. I was in Manassas, the last rally before that, which is even, I think, more emotional.
Yes.
And I think that I was trying to get to the core of people asking, what happened? What happened? Is it that voters were wrong, voters, independents, even Republicans, to paint such profound yearnings on this man at a time of crisis? Is it they who were wrong? Is it that Obama who changed? What happened here? And that was a question that I think animated much of the reporting as I pressed people as to the truth of who Obama is, what he felt, what he believes, what he tried to do in many cases, that he was not permitted to do, which I think is part of the edge of the book. Because now, as he, in his interview at the end of the book, talks about coming into his fullness, I have the staff I need, I'm going to be a more dynamic president, I'm not technocrat-in-chief, or he says, I suffer from the policy wonks disease of sitting in these endless policy debates, thinking a perfect solution will emerge from it. Obama is saying now, I'm past that. And so some people are saying, okay, fine. Susskind's book points out in internal memos, as well as in evidence, that the president wanted to be more dramatic, but was gamed, slow-walked, or in some cases ignored by his advisors, stymieing the president. What are those things the president wanted to do that he may now do as he is more enlivened, more dynamic, and essentially saying, I'm now a president that America needs in a crisis?
And do you sense, because you've done this substantial book, that there is a defining moment now, that the next 2 years will indeed be very different. And the guy that we saw at the bridge, who was calling out the Republicans and calling for jobs and rebuilding the infrastructure, which is something he was interested in doing years ago,
yeah,
you outline in the book.
In 2007.
Right. So is that finally going to happen?
Well, I mean, that's certainly the position of the White House. And when they're bringing me in, especially in the last third of my reporting, the last third of the book, it's about the comeback, about Obama's tough lessons during the middle period, which, of course, I've extensively reported. But the White House position is that, yes, that's right, but he learned from those hard lessons. What's the line from Shakespeare? Sweeter the uses of adversity? Well, the second part is, which, like the toad, ugly and venomous, bears a precious jewel in its forehead. I may not have every word, but I think it's pretty damn close.
It's pretty good.
And essentially, the White House is saying he found the jewel in the toad's forehead. Look at him now. And in the final interview, Obama is quite strident to say exactly that. Watch me now. Look, it was very tough. I learned how to be a boss. I learned, in essence, how to be the president during a difficult time when I arrived with very little experience managing, certainly exercising executive power, God knows, at a time of crisis, and watch me now. So I think that's really the big question, is that final push that the White House is convincing, and the president, too, in saying, look, he has the staff he needs. Obama says that. Watch him show his stuff. Is that where we are now? I mean, I think people will watch that over the next couple of weeks and judge for themselves.
Right. So let's talk about this change. He had people like Robert Reich, quite a different guy than Tim Geithner, advising him during the campaign. And all of a sudden we get in, and he was roundly criticized for this. You talk about a Rolling Stone interview that took place because he had to speak to progressives in the country wondering why he brought in all these Wall Street people. Why did he bring in, he said it was a lot of folks who understand the financial markets, but it was a completely different cast of characters and the policy changed quite dramatically. Why did he do that?
Well, you know, this is one of the central questions that the book examines, letter and verse. He did have this extraordinary team. I mean, not just Bob Reich, he had Paul Volcker.
Right.
I mean, the man, Paul speaks, I think, with great vigor and depth and insight in the book and in the interviews that we had as to, in a way, what might have been. What is the change? What occurred? I think what's interesting, Kathleen, is that that initial team spoke truly to Obama and what he felt during the campaign days. You know, they understood, I think with real clarity, as Volcker says, that the system of credit in the United States, which of course we're all part of, is busted, fundamentally busted, that Wall Street embraced over the years a disastrous business model, disastrous for the wider American economy, which in a nutshell is use the capital they have. It's something of a capital cartel, I call it, to invest overseas, where of course you're going to get terrific returns. You know, child labor is very profitable, let's just leave it at that, and no regulations as well. And then use those profits. That's the return on investment for much of the Wall Street distribution of capital, so-called. And meanwhile, saddle Americans and the American economy with much more debt than they can afford. But the key to the equation that allowed Wall Street to grow so vast and wealthy is to sever the ancient accountability that risk and debt has always brought. That you have to hold the risk if you're selling the debt, if you're lending money. Wall Street figured out a way to package the debt so that it didn't have accountability, meaning that the debt holders could collapse, but ultimately Wall Street could profit and not suffer consequences. It's a pass the hot potato kind of model. And government would step up to bail out Wall Street. That model, Volcker rages in the book, is busted.
Mm-hmm.
Obama had a chance to fix it.
Mm-hmm.
Early in his presidency, he doesn't do it. And I think historically people will say that was his great opportunity, an opportunity missed. He may not have another chance like that when Wall Street was on its knees, essentially saying, do what you need to do. You know, many of these Wall Street titans, you know, they're CEOs of big financial houses and whatnot, but they also were Americans. And many of them, that I interviewed as I went through the book said, look, you know, he needed to take us down. And he had the chance, and he didn't do it. And we were surprised, but once the profits came back, once the bonuses started again, the chance was passed.
And let's talk about the role of Geithner. You write at one point in the book that Geithner, at the time and looking back, saw this strictly in terms of confidence. Here's the title. Confidence, in fact, was Geithner's currency. He viewed his role then and later as assuring confidence in the financial markets by any means necessary at whatever cost. Was he the embodiment of that kind of confidence, and you couldn't say no to it if you were the president?
Well, I think what happened, Kathleen, is that Tim and Larry, Tim Geithner, Larry Summers, had a kind of a riff that they had embraced called Hippocratic risk. First, do no harm. That was the idea. Obama eventually embraces. At the beginning, I think he was struggling against it. Paul Volcker, when I interviewed him, basically said, first do no harm. If that's what you're going to embrace, and imagine, he says, when I was choking off money supply in the early 80s to kill inflation, first do no harm, I wouldn't have budged. And of course people said similar things then. If you're going to do something dramatic that changes the landscape, you're going to do harm. Maybe government's role is to soften the blow to some of those who are harmed, depending on where they fit on that landscape. But unless you embrace that idea, you're not going to do anything consequential. You're just going to keep the ball rolling forward. And I think Geithner's view was government should do whatever it takes to make sure that there is no change that's fundamental in the way Wall Street works and the way debt is packaged and sold, and really the way the great machines of New York, the financial capital, are more guiding the country than the ideals of public purpose in Washington. The thing that I'm interested that you mentioned, that Rolling Stone interview from the fall of 2010, because even then you see Obama not really getting it. When he talks about Larry and Tim to Rolling Stone being experts on Wall Street, like Joe Kennedy,
Right, like Joe Kennedy.
The SEC by Franklin Roosevelt.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a clean miss. I mean, the fact is Joe Kennedy is exactly the kind of guy Obama doesn't have. Somebody who is a master operator of Wall Street, who understands how all the games are played, who has made a lot of money from that, but is ready to now turn hard in a new direction, which is what Joe Kennedy does, to say, I'm leaving all that behind. If I'm never invited to dinner with those people again, so be it. I'm going to move boldly into public purpose. And, of course, Kennedy does that not only in his own life but in the hopes for his children. Obama needed a guy like that. He needed to convince one of the Wall Street titans that you've got all the money you need. Now you're going to go down in front of Congress early in 2009. You're going to pull a Richard Clark. You're going to apologize. You're going to say, we messed up, and I'm here to be the worst nightmare of Wall Street. I know all their tricks. I'm going to change them on behalf of Americans. They were not thinking that boldly, that dramatically, that strategically, sensibly, if you will. And instead they have Larry and Tim, who are not people who have that credibility or that toughness or that deep knowledge of how Wall Street's been making his money and how it's not working for America.
We're going to take phone calls. Ron Suskind is our guest. His book is Confidence Men, Wall Street, Washington, and the Education of a President. Our lines are filled. Keep the number in mind as we proceed. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this time period, another fabulous book. Candace Millard, author of Destiny of the Republic, A Tale of Madness, Medicine, and the Murder of a President. She set out to write about Alexander Graham Bell, but then she found out that he had worked day and night trying to save the life of President Garfield. And she eventually agreed with Bell that Garfield was, without question, one of the most extraordinary men ever elected president. She's with us tomorrow to talk about that story. Ron Suskind is here now. We start our calls with Mike in Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Oh, hi. Ron, you have written an excellent expose, but I think you're being a little bit too kind on the president. I'm a liberal. Let me say that first. Anyone who knows the history of this financial debacle knows that Larry Summers was a key architect in getting rid of Glass-Steagall, and Tim Geithner was a protege of Robert Rubin. Those guys are operators, and they're not confidence men, they're con men. And I think Barack Obama's appointment of those two guys demonstrates his incompetence, not his naivete, not his lack of experience. Barack Obama is incompetent, and he's trying to act now, and it's too little, too late.
Ron.
Yeah, well, thank you, Mike. I know people feel that way, and I think they're all reading this book page by page, and some of those views are being confirmed. You know, there is a disclosure in the book along with dozens of others, but one that I'm sure, Mike, you took notice of is that in the fall of 2008, Robert Rubin, who's the godfather of this whole group and the group that deregulated these financial services industries during the Clinton era and then profited from that deregulation, as many people in that Clinton era did afterward, he was offered a dollar-a-year job to have an office in the West Wing. You know, of this administration. Once Citigroup began to collapse, though, in the late fall, obviously that offer was not going to be tenable. You know, I think there's a moment that people are looking back on now. When Hillary and Obama debated during their primary battle, where Hillary Clinton said it's about experience, and Obama said it's about judgment. Obama, I think, triumphed in that debate, but now people are looking back to say, well, judgment doing what? What was his judgment in bringing in this team? And maybe that goes to the heart of a failure of judgment, to be blunt, by the president.
Mm-hmm. There were some better angels operating as his advisors. Talk, please, because this guy had some fabulous ideas and really was an extraordinary labor economist. He was the country's economist, really, the assistant treasury secretary, Alan Krueger.
Well, Krueger, of course, is somebody who walks through the length of this narrative from a meeting in 2007 in August with Obama, all the way through. Krueger is the leading labor economist in the United States. He's somebody that, interestingly, both left and right have a kind of affection for. He moves more or less wherever the data leads. That's not common for somebody in a senior role in government, that you have a real original researcher in that kind of job. When they get to that level, they often are decades past any real roll-up-the-sleeves research, not Krueger. And he leaves the government in the fall, late fall of 2010, to go back to Princeton. But then he's called back just recently to be chief of the Council of Economic Advisors, because he is a dynamic force. He's Mr. Jobs. He is very creative. And again, maybe that bespeaks the president's coming round, as the book sort of suggests he might, to recognize what worked and what didn't during those tumultuous first 2 years and making amends for it now as essentially an existential crisis of whether he's going to be reelected hits him squarely in the face every day. Krueger's now back in the big job, the Council of Economic Advisors, and a lot of people are waiting to see what he can manage.
Oh, that's fascinating. Yeah. Thanks, Mike. Scott in Green Bay, hi.
Good morning.
Hey, Scott.
I guess my comment is I've seen a lot of interviews that you've had regarding this book, and actually I think my copy shows up from Amazon today. It's interesting the reaction you're getting from the mainstream press. There seems to be pretty aggressive interviewing going on as opposed to what there was during the Bush book. And I'm wondering if the press, mainstream press, feels a bit threatened by this book because they all had it wrong with this guy. To quote Evan Thomas, and to disagree with him, he wasn't the one. I mean, they were so invested in this individual who really, I don't know how people missed it, had no business being in the Oval Office. He was totally incompetent and totally inexperienced for what lay in front of him. And I'm not really interested in the fact that, well, now he may have gotten his groove on and he might be a good president the next 4 years. This was a guy that really was immaculated, is brought in and really supportive as the guy that was going to be the one when there was really nothing to give us that idea that he was going
to. Let's go to your point about Ron facing pretty tough questioning on this book. What about that, Ron?
Look, every one of the Bush books got a pretty strong response. You know, if you recall back, the first of them that similarly to this book tore back the curtain for the first time in the Bush era and the Bush administration and ended up the price of loyalty in 2004. Of course, Paul O'Neill, the former Treasury Secretary, was the main source, but I had 19,000 documents. More than 100 sources cooperated. That ended up framing the Bush presidency. I think historians agree on that. At the time, of course, they were stunned. It's almost like, you know, the daylight hits them and they push back vigorously. The Bush administration launched a frivolous federal investigation of me and Paul O'Neill that we'd made off with classified documents. Of course, that dissolved 2 months later. But, you know, now, you know, you're dealing with an issue of power. It's always the way. It's not an issue of ideology or party. It's about the exercise of power. And when a White House like this gets challenged, as the evidence now is challenging them, the evidence laid out in this book, the reaction is vigorous. It has been vigorous. There are many journalists in Washington. It's a company town, and the leader of the town is Barack Obama, to be blunt. You know, understand how Washington works and has been working for some decades, I think more than ever, the access to those in power is a kind of currency. It affects the coverage of this White House. If you write a story and you're a daily reporter or working for a magazine and the White House is angry about it, you may lose access. That makes it more difficult for very able, tough reporters in Washington to do their job. It's different than it was when I started out 20, 25 years ago. Access is now used as a kind of weapon. What I can do in this book is I can dig deep. I can spend years with sources when they're in the White House, after they leave the White House. And so you're going to get the kind of disclosures here. This is something Bob Woodward and I actually talked about in 2006 after he had written some of his Bush books and I'd written some of mine about how much news is defaulting to the books now. And it's going to cause a tough reaction all around town from both reporters who want to curry favor with the White House and the White House saying, well, you know, I loved your column or whatever you did if it was attacking Ron. Or secondly, for reporters saying, my goodness, I spent 2 years at this and why didn't I report those things? I think what happens, though, in my experience, is after a bit, and it's happening now as people read the book, the dust kind of settles and reporters get to work. And they're getting to work now, and I think they will in the next couple weeks, for instance, to look at that big Pete Rouse memo. There's several memos from Pete Rouse, the shadow chief of staff, really in some ways Obama's most trusted longstanding aide. He was the chief of staff in the Senate office and a brilliant manager in Washington circles. Pete writes a memo to the president in February of 2010, which lays out the fact that Citibank is not just the only instance. He's been gamed, ignored, and spun by his people. And Pete Rouse's memo is a blueprint for how he can seize back control of his White House. So now the area for reporters to move is to find out what other things Obama wanted to do, but in a way was not allowed to do because he couldn't control his staff. They may be ideas that he now embraces, at least if you believe his notion that now he's going to get moving to move forward. That could essentially chart a new course for the president. That's where reporters are going now.
Hmm. Thanks for the call, Scott. Let's go to Bruce in Madison. Hi, Bruce.
Hi. I'm really excited to ask this question because it's been in the back of my mind for several years, and it's about the AIG bailout back at the beginning of the crisis. I read the book about John Paulson, who was the hedge fund manager who made billions from AIG by basically getting AIG to create insurance policies to protect him or to bet against the direction of a number of the derivatives. And one thing that I've always wondered, Ron, is, and I hope you can explain this, is when I got an MBA many years ago, we were told that to issue an insurance policy, the policyholder had to have an insurable interest. So
yes.
I can get insurance on my house. I can't buy insurance on your house because I have nothing to lose if your house goes up in flames. Mm-hmm. So how is it that AIG is allowed to write basically these kinds of insurance policies to someone who doesn't own the underlying security?
Oh, what's your name again?
If you could answer that.
This is Bruce.
Bruce, I love your question. Okay. The issue, insurable interest, that concept was developed in the 1700s in England because that was the early day of a miracle product, insurance. Insurance was the first product that really dealt with the innovations in mathematics. The theory of probability attached it to statistical breakthroughs in that period and created a pricing of risk. And that pricing of risk, as precision grows and grows, as there's more data behind it as to how risk really would impact things like fire downtown or someone's death or whether a ship will sink, that forms the basis in so many ways for what we now call the modern economy, pricing risk and pricing it right. The key was, as you say, you couldn't have an insurable interest. You needed an insurable interest. You couldn't essentially take out insurance on a boat that you didn't own, that you had no interest in protecting in terms of its value. They got that in the 1700s in England. The brilliance, often diabolical brilliance, of the credit default swaps was that they managed to unravel that age-old principle. So you could have 1,000 people betting on whether someone would pay their mortgage, having no real dog in the fight, so to speak. This is old stuff. You know, I think the key is that Wall Street figured out a way to wriggle free from one of the oldest standards in investing that's right at the heart of pricing risk correctly across the economic landscape. When risk is mispriced, which is what happened here, all sorts of devils emerge. And those devils created a bubble, bubble to bubble to bubble, across many periods in the last 25 or 30 years. And the fact is that bubble is still out there because risk remains mispriced in America, backed up by a government view that debt should be sacrosanct, that debt should never take a haircut or consequences for the bad investment of debt. Protecting debt with the government backing now is creating so much of the havoc that we experienced even last week, where the markets were just gyrating up and down. Why? Because unless you deal with that issue of risk and debt being mispriced, you're not going to earn real confidence, lasting confidence, that allows for people to hunker down, say, look, I can invest, I can move forward. We're not going to be running up and down these roller coasters again, often to the profit of Wall Street. Someone has stepped up. This president, this White House didn't do it. It had its chance, and I think historically that's the big miss.
Hmm. Thanks, Bruce, for the call. Tom on the road. Hi.
Hi, good morning. It's a real pleasure to talk to you, Mr. Susskind, and I look forward to reading your book. I have two basic quick questions here. First of all, I was wondering if you are aware of this Occupy Wall Street movement, I guess you could call it, or whatever's happening there on Wall Street, with the young kids kind of marching on Wall Street, and what your thoughts on that are, especially because the Main Street media has been just silent on this. You virtually hear little or nothing about what's going on there. But my other important question is, I'd like to kind of get back to what that first caller said at the beginning. You know, he mentioned Robert Rubin and Tim Geithner. I think we have to add one more name to the list, and that would be Henry Paulson. We've had three secretaries of the Treasury now that have direct ties to Goldman Sachs, and I think this is where the root of all evils lie when we're talking about Wall Street. It is Goldman Sachs, and I'd like to know what your thoughts on that are.
I don't know if I would place it all on the doorstep of Goldman Sachs. I think they are often the most vigorous at pushing the edge of the envelope, so to speak, in terms of what financial services companies are doing, maybe they shouldn't be doing. I think that what is clear, though, is that the passage of senior executives from Goldman Sachs to this government has been at the heart of exactly the kind of revolving door that has been ruinous for the wider issues of policy, of doing something that's greatest good for greatest number, which is government's role. You know, the bottom line here is that Paul Volcker looks at this and others who are original advisors saying America would be fine without Goldman Sachs. There are other people who can't imagine the country without Goldman Sachs. And I think that's a key divide. You know, when you've got so much interest invested for so many of the actors in companies like Goldman or Citibank or Citigroup, where you know, they may have been, where their friends are, where they're hoping to go back to after their service in government. Look, you simply have a conflict of interest. I think that's one of the reasons a lot of readers are seeing a very interesting character in the book named Gary Gensler. Now, Gensler is a Goldman alum. He's made a fortune at Goldman Sachs, but he did a kind of Joe Kennedy turn. Now, he's not a senior person in the government at the level of Summers or Geithner, but he is in a key role. He's head of the Commodities Future Trading Commission, which is there to regulate the vast derivatives market, the CDOs, the CDSs, all of that stuff. And Gensler ends up being really in a kind of one-man crusade more and more. The Treasury Department and Geithner ends up not being very supportive of Gary. But Gary Gensler, you know, is, well, right now he's sort of fighting a one-man battle to have Wall Street face accountability, to rein in the derivatives market, which is this vast $600 trillion, you know, monstrosity across the globe in which these bets are laid down. Bets without insurable interest in large measure. And, I think that this is the core of the struggle at this period between our financial and political capitals, between the two great power centers in America. And I think there's no doubt that New York has won almost every battle,
mm-hmm.
for the most part.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call. Let's go back to Geithner for a moment, because one of the things that's caused controversy in the book and that you lay out pretty thoroughly is Geithner's ignoring the president's desires when it came to Citibank. And you've got a lot of, as you outline, Obama's fiercest protectors. You write Axelrod and others on his political staff increasingly concerned that Geithner was a liability who not only stood in the way of tough and politically advantageous measures against Wall Street, but drew the charge. The administration was in Wall Street's back pocket. He was a lightning rod. The sparks were hitting Obama, and they have hit Obama significantly. Why is he still there? Why isn't he gone? I still don't get this.
Well, I think people are asking that question this week, right before the book came out, just a day or two before, James Carville, of course, stepped up rather famously, saying this president needs to knock some heads, fire some people, and show he's the boss, and show that this is a new Barack Obama, and follow him forward. And of course, people were saying, you know, Tim Geithner should be the first guy on the list. You know, Geithner wanted to leave a few months ago. For whatever reason, the president was apparently very strident in convincing him to stay. His relationship, Geithner and the president, is very complex. It's one I plumb some in the book, but it's the kind of thing that probably we won't know fully until the memoirs come out of one or both men. And, you know, Geithner is the last man standing. So the questions being directed now at Geithner, are bringing up the heat as to why Tim Geithner has that job still. I mean, I direct readers, if they've heard some of Tim Geithner's pushback publicly, and many of the pushbacks fall under the traditional Washington walkback category, where people throw out very careful, complex, non-denial denials. I don't remember having said that, or you know, I never would say that, or it's hearsay, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Geithner and the other key actors in the book respond in the book's pages to the key disclosures. That was one of the things that I really stressed, is that I was going to go back to everybody, have them respond to exactly what was in the book next to their name in the book's pages. And Tim Geithner's response to the issue of whether he slow-walked the president, so to speak, on the president's dramatic move to try to restructure and take down some of the big banks, he responds to Tim in two long pages of quotes as we go step by step through something that virtually everybody agrees about, what happened there. And his response, I think, if you read it, it definitively shows that the book's conclusions are correct, that he slow-walked the president.
Ron Susskind, our guest. More calls in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's an email from Sue in Colorado. Ron, here's a chance for you to take this conversation anywhere you want. So what do we do now? What should President Obama do now?
Okay. Well, you know, there are a variety of proposals that the president might look at now that are a bit off the grid to spur the economy in new ways that are out there. I mean, one that I hear a lot of is to stop essentially paying interest to banks on reserves, which is a way to the Fed is sort of bribing the banks not to lend to business all the extra money that they now have by paying interest on the excess reserves they hold. If they don't do that, if the Fed says we're going to change course, it could be as much as a trillion and a half dollars that goes to the economy. You know, there are other issues like that where quietly but firmly the government is still supporting the banks to do whatever the banks feel they want to do for whatever reason, and mostly the banks say we want to be profitable with as little real risk as we can manage. And the broader issue that is brought up throughout the book is that we have a problem of deficient aggregate demand. There's not enough demand in the economy. Until there is an uptick in demand, you know, no one wants to lend or build or grow right. or invest. Well, you know, this has been going on for a long time. The president, a lot of people are saying, just needs to get out there and try some things and not worry about the kind of mess of will this create unintended and consequences that will outrun the intended consequences. The key now, I think, is for the president to kind of throw a bit of caution to the wind and continue to move forward to say, I'm going to get out there and start swinging, both in terms of policy and also in terms of the political conversation. Clearly, consensus, finding good things in the opponent's arguments and finding middle ground has not worked. It frankly hasn't worked for many years in America. It mostly means that we drift forward on the same path from which we came. Now it's a time for a course correction. Let's see what Barack Obama can manage.
Wayne in Holman. Hi, Wayne.
Hey, good morning, Kathleen.
Hi, Wayne.
Good morning, Ron. Go Brewers.
Hey, Wayne.
Go Brewers. I'm with you. Right.
Can I ask you one quick question or comment, Kathleen, before I speak with your wonderful guest?
Yes.
I missed the program where you had your husband and your son on.
I know. Yes, I did.
I wanted to ask your son if he knew the middle names of all the Brewers, and I'll bet he did.
I'll ask him that when I see him again.
Anyway, okay. I thank you for taking my call.
Sure,
Mr. Suskind, and I find you to be very balanced and fair. I can't tell if you come from the right or left, and that's a good thing. But I would ask you, and when I heard President Obama speak, I think I, like most Americans, I was in rapture. I mean, this guy really caught my attention. However, have some concerns. I recall when he and John McCain were starting the campaign, or going to, they both pledged to take public funding. And I'll ask your comments, sir. John McCain dotted the I's and crossed the T's and signed on the dotted line, and President Obama reneged on it. Now, maybe that was just a lack of judgment, but don't you think a man's word is a test of his mettle? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Wayne. Thanks for the call.
All right. I'll answer this based, again, on the reporting. There's a part of the book in the fall of 2010 when one of the senior officials to the president meets for dinner with the guys who run the Gallup organization.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a fascinating dinner because the question is about confidence. What's the core of it? How do you gain it? How do you lose it? How do you grow it? And the head of Gallup says what they find in poll after poll is the key quotient is the distance between word and deed. That even when a leader says something that maybe is not that popular, if his deeds follow his words, people tend to go along with him. It's a kind of straight shooter thing, the Gallup chief says. You know, that he says what he means, so at least I know where he's going, and he clearly seems to be firm in those convictions because deeds follow words. I think it's clear to state at this point that through the campaign and certainly through the administration, the president has often had a gap between words that often are soaring and inspirational and deeds that in many cases are far less than that without an explanation as to why there's such a distance. And I think that goes to the core of how This is the theme of the book. Confidence remains the coin of the realm. It's what, you know, Roosevelt restoring confidence in a crisis establishes his legacy. Kennedy, as well, brings a burst of confidence to his generation. Reagan, a master of working the fabric of confidence. If you're to earn sustainable confidence, words and deeds need to match up. And I think that's where the president has had some real trouble.
Yeah. Oh, Ron, what a pleasure to speak with you. I look forward always to whatever work you're going to do. It's you're just really good, and thank you.
No, it's always my pleasure, Kathleen. Maybe we can talk again in a couple weeks, and as people read the book, they're going to have more questions.
Oh, hey, we'll do that.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, Ron. Thank you. You too. Ron Susskind, his new book is Confidence, Men, Wall Street, Washington, and the Education of a President. We've had him on several times before. He's also author of The Way of the World, The 1% Doctrine, The Price of Loyalty, and A Hope in the Unseen. Please listen to us tomorrow during this time period, the story of President Garfield, a president I don't know very much about, but our guest will say one of the most fascinating people to ever be elected president, as is the story of his assassination. He didn't die from the bullet wound. Candace Millard will be with us. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Chrissy Pease.